Okay, so just a couple announcements too before we start. Guest lectures coming up. Hopefully everyone saw my email on Piazza, which is Eric Leingell will be here in 2 weeks from today, the 29th. And Eric's going to give a talk on game engine architecture, which I think will be really good. I think a lot of people are interested in the topic, and we spend a lot of time talking about algorithms and the sort, but maybe we don't spend as much time talking about the actual architecture. And Eric is definitely an expert in that area, being that he's edited the game engine gem series. Sorry, let me reconnect this projector so we get a better aspect ratio. Oh, I guess we'll deal with this. Also, remember class on Halloween Day, we canceled it and we're moving it one day earlier. So we're going to be in the SIG lab right underneath of us. If you don't have access to the SIG lab, just go ahead and like knock on the door and someone will let you in. Does anyone know how this projector works? I obviously don't. Restart what? Oh, I don't know. That sounds like it'll take an incredibly long time. My phone takes like 2 minutes to boot. I don't know how long this projector is going to take. I don't know. I usually don't have problems with this. So this would probably be the first time in the history of me teaching this class that this has not worked out. So I'm going to, for the most part, I'm going to use the desktop then, because I don't think that's fair for you guys to have to look at those slides like that. Okay, that's better. Okay, so that's the deal for the class. The other thing that I wanted to say was just a little maybe general software engineering build versus buy. Libraries. Can I use this third-party library? How do I use this third-party library? I don't know how to use the third-party library. You come to me and say, I want to use this library. And if I haven't used it, I don't know how to use it. The different people architect libraries different ways, and my job, my primary job, or what I spend 90% of my time on, is on making software libraries, and I make our library such that it just works. Like, you just drop it in and it works every time. Most people don't, and that can make it harder to use, and that is, they are making software not as well as they can. So sometimes you might have to read a bunch of instructions on how to get their library to work. And they really should be working on, like, just make it build out of the box, you know. And so just be aware that if you want to use XYZ library, usually the answer is yes, you can use that library. And please ask on Piazza so that everyone knows that you can use that library. But the answer is, Patrick, do you know how to use this library? The answer is probably no. But I could read the readme just like you could. So please read it. And if you have trouble or you come up with tips on how to do it, just please share with everyone. So just be aware of that. Okay, so I want to talk about the graphics pipeline today and Wednesday, because we've done a bunch of CUDA stuff. We talked about GPU architecture. We built our GPU ray tracer. We built our GPU path tracer. And now I want to build a GPU rasterizer. And we could just use an API like OpenGL, and later in the semester we will use OpenGL. But I want you to be able to implement a rasterization engine in CUDA, because it will really give you an understanding for how something like OpenGL works and how you can write efficient real-time rendering code. And the graphics pipeline that I'm going to present here is pretty much based on OpenGL ES2, which is the standard that runs on all of our phones and is the backbone for WebGL that runs in our browser. And it really is the basis for the modern pipeline on the desktop, but the modern pipeline on the desktop is even more complicated. And I feel that the pipeline for the full OpenGL 4.3 pipeline, which I handed out, or sorry, I handed out the 4.2 pipeline on the first day of class, it's a beast. There's a lot of parts going to it. And if you implement a subset of a rasterization pipeline in CUDA, I think that you're really going to have a, you're really going to be prepared to, when you see, oh, here's compute shaders, and here's tessellation shaders, you're going to be in a good situation to understand those and to even perhaps even help innovate with the future of the graphics pipeline. So that's why we're going to do the rasterizer. And like, I mean, so far all the projects that we've done this semester are new. We didn't do them last semester, although Carl, Peter, and Shin, they all did path tracers, GPU path tracers, for their final project. So that's how we're stepping up this course. What was previously final projects are now regular projects. So what amazing things will you do for your final projects that we're going to roll into the course? So think about that and go really hard, because then it'll be really hard for the students next semester. Okay, so I will briefly give a graphic review, which is bread and butter for you guys. You guys already know it, but really it's just to position the real-time rendering that we're going to be talking about. And then we'll jump through and we'll walk through the graphics pipeline. And this is something that you'll implement in CUDA, although what you will do is even simpler than the pipeline I will show here, because we're going to look at some stages and we're going to talk about it. Some stages in this pipeline aren't needed, or they're really there for, say, performance, or for it to be very general. And for your pipeline, we're going to allow it to be more specific so that we can scope it so you can code it, you know, quickly. And then towards the end, and this won't be the Wednesday, we'll talk about taking this pipeline and how it maps to the GPU hardware. Because ultimately, what I'm going to describe here, I will talk about the GPU a little bit while I'm going through the pipeline, but really it's just a general graphics concept. And you should have seen, or you definitely saw this in 460, although you might not have seen it in all the detail that we will talk about, or certainly programmed it in the detail that we will program it in. Right, so the big field of computer graphics, what most of you guys are studying, I could break it down into like three big areas. One would be modeling, that is, how do you describe objects in the scene, how do you describe the scene itself. And right now we've been doing basically spheres and boxes that you've been doing in your ray tracer and path tracer. Some of you are also doing triangles. And then there's the field of rendering, which is given that scene, generate an image. And then that field can be, and all these fields can be broken up. I mean, it's amazing how many subfields there are in computer graphics. But one of the fields for rendering is real-time rendering, which is generating an image such that you can interact with it quick enough such that you feel that it's fluid. And that can be 60 frames per second. It can mean maybe 30 frames per second. Maybe 15. A video game wouldn't be 15, but maybe something like data visualization after you get only 15. But let's say 60 is a pretty common thing. In fact, I read someone's bio, and I think it was in like GPU, it might have been GPU Pro 1. You know, like, I live my life in 16 milliseconds. And that's because one frame, typically you'd have 16 milliseconds to render that frame. And it's funny, because real-time rendering isn't even the end of a field. Like, there's even subfields to that, like real-time shadows. So there's an entire book on real-time shadows, just on rendering shadows in real-time. It's very, very amazing. Even my virtual globe book, I guess you would kind of categorize under that, maybe with some other categories off to the side. So there's modeling, the render, and then everyone here, I'm sure, has studied or is currently studying animation, right, which is really the movement of the objects in the scene. Right, so a few things just for modeling. Sometimes I see literature and it goes, we're this many polygons, or I can render this many polygons per second. But I don't care. I only care about triangles. So like the GPU, we've been using CUDA, which uses just the general processors, but the GPU has fixed function hardware that can rasterize triangles, not polygons. So do you guys, why do you think that's the case? Why not just do polygons? They're more general. They have to be useful. Yep. Go ahead.
Triangles are guaranteed to be planar.
Right. So triangles are guaranteed to be planar. They're guaranteed to be convex. They're just overall simpler. If I asked you to rasterize a triangle, it's a lot easier than to rasterize an arbitrary polygon. Did we talk about this maybe on the first day of class? Or at some point we might have talked about this, but just so we're on the same page, right? And when I say rasterization,
everyone knows what I mean. I mean finding the pixels that cover, or the pixels that a triangle covers. So that's where an image, et cetera, et cetera there. So for a triangle, it's easier to do the rasterization compared to, well, here's one polygon, maybe that's not too bad. Here's another one. And suddenly you're a lot harder, you know. So triangles really simplify the hardware. And if you model something with polygons, which people often do, it will be converted to triangles as part of the like a pre-processing step. You might wind up doing it on the fly if you want to, but a lot of times, definitely in the world of games, you would do this as a pre-processing step, and then when you go to load the game, it's already been stored as triangles, so there's no extra processing at load time, so it's really fast. But in terms of triangles, say an object is a bunch of triangles, and I know a few of you put in the OBJ loaders, how would you store your model? Like, let's start with, what's a naive data structure for storing a triangle mesh?
Just triangles?
Just triangles?
Just,
so let's not even think about normals. Let's just think about positions that make up the vertices. So you're saying store three positions for every triangle?
That's one way.
So I agree. Does everyone agree with that? This will be a really simple model, but say this thing has P0, P1, P2, P3. One way that we could store this would be P0, P1, P2. Then we might say P1, P2, P3, where each of these has an XYZ component. Oops, sorry, I messed that up. P0, P1, P3, P1, P2, 3, P3. So it's this triangle, and this triangle. So this is one data structure, right? This could be an array, right? Okay, so what's good about this data structure? I'll answer that question. It's really simple, and everyone gets it, right? So what's maybe less optimal about this? So duplicate vertices, maybe in this case, geez, P1, P3. So these guys are stored twice. Right. Okay, so how else could we store this data? The faces? Okay, so you said I store the vertex data like this, maybe I go P0. P1, P2, P3. And that one right there? Now what?
Take a face, first face would be minus of 0 1.
0, 1, 3. And what's the second face? Okay, so what teacher is saying is we could just store all the unique vertices, all the unique positions, and we have a separate array of perhaps unsigned short, so 16 bits. These are typically 16 bits, and these are just indexes or pointers into the main array here, and you can interpret every three of these as one triangle. And now instead of duplicating P1 and P3, all the vertice data, we're only duplicating the index data, which is typically much less. So for some models, this can be more data if there's no connectivity, there's a bunch of random triangles. But for most, for just like any sane model out there, this is always going to be more efficient. And certainly the graphics hardware has a number of features to make this efficient in terms of caching. Well, vertex data can be quite a bit. So position might be floating point, XYZ, which is 12 bytes, or it might be double, and a lot of the work I do is double precision, and it's 24 bytes. Most games don't necessarily have to deal with that. But a vertex might have more than position, right? You guys said normal, it can have
color, it can have tangents, and it might have all this user-defined stuff, like temperature, for example. So these usually get quite big, and the indices are usually much smaller. So this trade-off here, this is called an index triangle, makes a lot of sense, and is widely done. Let's see, what else do I want to say about this? There's other things that you can do, too. So this is general and useful, but there's more focused things that you can do, like triangle fans and triangle strips, where you assume something about the triangles. Like, for example, a triangle fan say this is P0, P1, P2, P3, P4. We just store this out in an array, and we say P0, P1, P2. And now every new point, say, for example, P3, connects the first point and the previous point. So P3 makes this part of the fan, and then P4 connects again the first one, P0, and the previous one, P3, to do this. So it's implicitly saying, oh, I'm going to fan it out, or you can strip it around. And these, for certain models, these can be useful, you know, but they're just not as general. So it used to be, in like the late 90s, maybe, you know, say late 90s, you could write people, it was very popular to have algorithms, a processor, that would take a triangle soup, which is what we call this guy here, and then convert it to a bunch of triangle strips, which are pretty similar to fans. But then the index triangles came around, and the caches on the GPUs came around. This is definitely the method of choice now. I assume, did you guys do this in 460? Yes, I know so. So everyone, you know, is completely understands. We decompose the scene in the triangles, and then we can render those triangles. And then, of course, we don't necessarily need to have triangles. We can have implicit surfaces, which is what you've been doing with the spheres. This one here, this is procedural terrain. This is from GPU Gems. It might be GPU Gems 3. GPU Gems 3. This is procedural terrain done with a series of noise functions. And we wind up doing marching cubes in the geometry shader here, which is a part of the rasterization pipeline we'll talk about later in the semester. If you're interested, so this, you know, this was not modeled by some person, or the data wasn't acquired and then stored. This is done on the fly with a bunch of evaluation of noise functions. If you guys are interested in work like this, I think it's a really good project to do. Both procedural generation of the scene, but also procedural shading, too. So instead of explicitly storing textures, synthesizing them. And I think there's a lot of fun work there. And I think as the gap between bandwidth and processing continues to widen, these procedural techniques are going to become more and more important. Okay, so the whole thing for rendering, the whole field of rendering is like, here's my scene, and that has the geometry, the materials, lights, camera, really, those could be the major components. Here's my scene, give me an image. And then the camera moves, and then you get a new image. Or the objects move, and you get a new image. But it's the opposite question that we've been asking with ray tracing and path tracing. In ray tracing and path tracing, we said, here's a pixel, go through this scene and figure out what color it is. In rasterization, not general rendering, but in rasterization, that's what we're talking about. It's about, here's a triangle, what pixels does it cover? So it's like it's the opposite thing. And rasterization is currently the way that we do real-time rendering, and the hardware is very well optimized for it, and we'll talk about the Z buffer in particular and the implementation of the Z buffer in the GPU. So what we've done so far with ray tracing and path tracing is potentially up and coming, as you could almost joke and say ray tracing has been up and coming. Real-time ray tracing has been up and coming for 15 years, but I have a feeling that we are going to get there. Okay, so like we could break down rendering into two parts. One is finding visible surfaces, which I'm sure you did a bunch of in 460 with Painter's algorithm, VSP trees, and the depth buffer, the Z buffer. And then when you did this with your ray tracers, just you shot your ray and the closest object was, that's what, when you found, when you picked the closest one, that was the visible surface as part of that. And then the second part is, of course, shading. What is the color of this picture, pixel? How do I simulate the interaction with the material and the light to get the surface color? And again, in your rasterizer, you would do both of these. Unlike the path tracer, you will probably spend more time on the visible surfaces than you will on the shading. For the shading, I'll be okay with a simple Blinn-Fong approximation or a Fong or any just bread and butter shading algorithm. I really want you just to get the rasterization pipeline in, and I think that the visible surfaces part is one of the more interesting parts of it. So if you had trouble with that on the path tracer, you probably won't have trouble with it on the rasterizer. However, nothing's going to stop you from doing beautiful shading in your rasterizers. You know, I certainly won't stop you from doing that, and I will encourage it. And you're welcome to share code, if any code from your previous projects, your personal previous project, not someone else's previous project. If any of that code is useful to you in your rasterizer for shading in particular, you can have that, absolutely. Okay, and then, you know, the animation, like I say, things move, and we have 100 courses on animation here, so I won't repeat any of them, considering that is probably my weakest area of computer graphics. But I do want to get you in the habit of thinking about 60 frames per second, 16 milliseconds. It's not a lot of time here. So, and we have a lot of pixels to shade, or as you saw, a lot of rays to shoot. So a lot of this is going to be on optimization. Like, yeah, we can talk about how to do rendering pretty quickly and pretty easily, but a lot of what you see is in the pipeline is to make things go faster. So this is the graphics pipeline on your left-hand side. And like I say, I'm not going to assign it to a particular technology, but it is pretty much spot on with OpenGL ES. And this is what we will build on, and we will look at more stages of this later in the semester. But I don't want to introduce like this giant, crazy pipeline all at once. Like, you guys, let me help you recall the entire modern pipeline for, at least for OpenGL 4.2, which doesn't even include compute shaders. All right, so here's our book, and Christoph made this pipeline map that I handed out on the first day. This is, so up here, this right here, is an OpenGL ES2 pipeline. Full description of it, Christoph is very good. It's up right to the spec right here. This box right here, plus all of this, is the OpenGL 4.2 pipeline. So it would be impractical for us to try to go through this entire pipeline before we finish anything. So I'd rather go through what is really this guy right here, which is a high-level view of the ES pipeline. I want to go through that today and Wednesday, and later in the semester, we're going to kind of cherry-pick the most interesting parts of this 4.2 pipeline. Which is also, you know, I will be doing OpenGL because I know OpenGL, but Direct3D is very similar too. In fact, the concepts are the same. There might just be some different names. Okay, so with the graphics pipeline, the scene goes in and the pixels come out, right? So we can think of it here. We just have vertices. They're going to go through all these various stages. And we're going to output an image to the frame buffer, I'm going to call it. And the frame buffer will actually have multiple buffers. For your rasterizers, you will have at least two buffers. One will be the color values, and one will be what we'll call depth values that you'll use to find the visible surfaces. So just to, even though it's called frame buffer, it is composed of multiple distinct buffers. Okay, so this first stage of the pipeline, is called vertex assembly, and I'm surprised that in OpenGL ES they call it primitive processing, because this doesn't work on a whole primitive. A primitive is like a triangle or a line is a primitive. A vertex is just one point, so to speak, in that triangle. So I think primitive processing is not the best name, but vertex assembly. And again, there's no quizzes on. I'm not going to ask you to memorize terms and regurgitate them, although you will be implementing these stages, and some of these stages will be very trivial to implement, but for what is a vertex, I do want this terminology to be pretty clear. Let's start at the bottom. A component is just like an intrinsic value. It could be a float, could be a double, could be an int. It's just one value. And then when you combine these into something with some semantics, we call that an attribute. So you could have a position, you could have a normal texture coordinate. Those are probably the three most common things you would see stored for in a model. Like I said, you may also see various tangents and bitangents, just other vectors than the normal pointing in other directions. And then you may see user-defined data that's just specific to the app. So when you combine all these attributes, then you have a vertex, right? So a vertex is not necessarily a position. A position is not necessarily a vertex, but most often a vertex contains a position. Does that make sense? You guys obviously shouldn't have been doing this all along. Okay. So, well, what does this vertex assembly stage mean? Like, you know, I made my model loader, and I made an array of this stuff. I made an index array of this stuff, and then I'm done. You know, what do you mean assemble a vertex, right? So, when you give your data to OpenGL, it could pull it out a lot of different ways, and that stage where it says, well, what is one given vertex? That's called the vertex assembly stage, and it's very trivial from our explanation point of view. It's very trivial, and in your pipeline, I expect it to be very easy as well. But here, let's say I have a bunch of positions, and I have corresponding texture coordinates, then I also have corresponding normal, binormal, and tangents. So, why would I want these? Do you guys know? Local something sounding good, right? So these are useful for things like normal mapping and bump mapping if you want to work in tangent space. You guys have all seen normal mapping and bump mapping in 4.6, right? So these are good for to basically go from tangent space to high space or vice versa. And these form a local coordinate system. So all these vectors should be orthogonal to each other. So if you ever dot any of them, you get zero. Or usually orthonormal, they're normalized as well. You could also, if you want to save memory, you can only store two of them and then do a cross product to get the third one as well. And this is just example data too that I'm showing. Like, this is not part of the graphics pipeline. This is me showing you example data to talk about what is vertex assembly. So here, say we had all these arrays coming in. Vertex 0 pulls out one position, one textual coordinate, and then the normal, binormal, and bitangent. So in this case, the position and the texture coordinates, these are in parallel arrays. Okay, the normal, binormal, and bitangent, those are three different attributes, but they're interleaved in the same array. Does everyone know what I say when I say interleaved? So it goes normal, binormal, bitangent, and then for the next vertex, there'll be another one. In fact, we'll see that here. So it's just a way to organize the data. And in fact, there's lots of different ways to do this. So we could have also interleaved everything. We could have used one big array and said position, texture coordinates, normal, binormal, bitangent. Or we could have made five separate arrays, one for each attribute. Position, texture coordinates, normal, binormal, bitangent. And there's various trade-offs here. Definitely from the OpenGL point of view, if it's all static data, and if you interleave everything, you typically get a small performance gain. It used to be bigger, but now, and the work that I've seen is still about 4 years old. In fact, I tried to get someone to write a chapter on this in my book, in OpenGL Insights, to be like, hey, look, tell me now, on most modern hardware, how important it is to interleave. But we didn't get any budge for that chapter. But if you're looking to write a proposal for the second edition, that would get some attention, at least from one of the editors for the book. So that's one reason. But the other reason is, you might want to separate certain data if some of it changes and some of it doesn't. Like, say you have a model and the positions frequently change, but none of the other data changes. You would only want to have to update the positions and not jump through all, you know, something that's interleaved and just cherry pick parts of it and upload it. So think of these like these are buffers, or this is stuff that you allocated with CUDA malloc, and then you're sending it down to your kernels. So just I recommend dividing this based on the update frequency. So what do you guys think? That's Vertex assembly. Is that easy? Okay, so the next stage is called the vertex shader, and this is what takes an individual vertex and transforms it into clip coordinates. So this is starting to do the 3D transforms. And the 3D transforms in ray tracing is kind of like implicit. At least the perspective that you get is implicit. You shoot the ray through a pixel, and it happens to be in perspective because you shot it from the position of the viewer, as opposed to something that's orthographic, but you shot the ray straight in. So this here does, the vertex shader can also do any type of per vertex computation. So it's not just doing a couple of matrix multiplies to get you in the clip coordinates, but you might want to do things like skidding for models when you're bending them, or anything. I'll show you a pulsing example in a minute, or even sometimes people will do simulation, like particle simulation in a vertex shader. Although now with the compute shaders as part of the pipeline, I think the compute shader is a better place. Before we had GPUs that were generally programmable, you know, we just burnt in certain graphics algorithms into them, they called this stage TNL, transform and lighting. Do you guys have any idea why this stage is called transform and lighting? So, because that's literally what it did, transform and lighting. It, as I said up here, it transformed incoming vertex position from model to clip coordinates. And I'll refresh your memory on what that means, model and clip coordinates. But it also did lighting. So we used to evaluate the lighting, fixed function hardware to evaluate it per fragment, per vertex, and it would interpolate it. And you and your ray tracers, you guys evaluate the lighting per fragment or per pixel, which leads to better quality. I have some pictures for that too. And then just here, some of this math that I'm showing down here, and I'm not a heavy math guy, right? I guess I haven't done any formal proofs this semester, and I will never do a formal proof, and I also won't bombard you guys with math left and right, but I will show you the parts that you need to know. But this is just showing a position in model coordinates and then multiplying by this model view projection matrix that we'll break down to get the position in clip coordinates. And these will be 4x4 matrices. And why are they 4x4? Homogeneous coordinates, because these can do both the rotation translation and scaling. Right. So otherwise, a 3x3 can just do the scale and rotation, but the 4x4 has that right-hand column that allows us for the translation. Okay, so we could do what I showed you here, where I had this matrix all burned together. And everyone knows that we can multiply these matrices together to concatenate the transforms. But here we can do it separately, and I'm showing you that we're going from model to world coordinates, and world to eye, and eye to clip. And the difference here is that, well, one, this is slower, because it's three vector matrix multiplies instead of just one. But this also gives you some flexibility. So a lot of times when I do lighting, for example, in eye coordinates, and we want the position not only in clip coordinates because we need it to do the rasterization, but we also want the eye coordinates later so that we can do lighting. So when you can, it's good to burn these matrices together, these transform matrices together, so that you're doing less matrix multiplies, because you can have lots of vertices. You might have millions of vertices, and your scene is not, for a real-time scene, is not uncommon. Hundreds of millions is pushing it at this point, but it may not be a few years from now. So just know the combination, you know, just know what your trade-offs are. Generally speaking, I would figure out where my target coordinate systems are, then I would just concatenate whatever I can to minimize it. So this vertex shader stage has a vertex comes in, then the modified vertex comes out, and that is kind of like, well, what is that? So one is the position comes in model coordinates, and it comes out in clip coordinates. But a vertex might have other stuff too, right, that's associated with it, like temperature or any other data. And you can change that as you see fit and output it. And one of these things coming into this, so you can think of these as being in like global memory, or you know, you could mem with them. But there can also be this data coming in the side that is more like constants you could think of it, or just parameters that you pass to your function that in OpenGL terms we call uniforms. And these are the values that are constant for all the vertices. So for example, these matrices that I'm showing you, every vertex goes on the same, every matrix is used for this, for a different vertex. And I just want to introduce these terms like uniform and vertex shader. So even though that in your code you could call it like whatever you want to, but like where do you see it? When we start doing OpenGL and GLSL, it's just going to be like obvious. Like I don't even have to tell you anything. You'll be like, oh, I already know everything. You just didn't tell me that you were telling it to me. Okay, so anyway, in case these matrices are scaring you because you haven't seen them in a while, the models are defined usually in a local model coordinate system, and a model might have several coordinate systems within it for convenience. And the model matrix transforms to some common world coordinate system. So, for example, in this room, the origin could be down at this corner with axes coming out, and then each chair might be in its local coordinate system, and the model matrix would position it in the work coordinate system. So in 462, I'm sure you've seen a ton of this. And in 460, you must have gotten through 460 by then seeing this as well. For like your assignments, I won't ask you to derive these matrices or to like GLM has code that you can use to compute these, and especially for like the perspective ones. So don't feel that like you're gonna have to do a bunch of math to derive this stuff. And those of you that did the interactive camera, you were creating a view matrix by manipulating the the position and the look-at direction and so on. Okay, so then we go to world to eye coordinates, which is the next transform step, because we're trying to go from model to clip coordinates. So here what happens is we wind up positioning the camera so that it's at the origin and it's looking down the negative z value. So eye coordinates can be useful. Sometimes manipulation in eye coordinates can be useful for like really dumb stuff. Like I have this model because I do like a lot of visualization work. Maybe I have a model and I'm trying to put text in front of it. So in eye coordinates, I might translate the text x number of units so that it's always in front of the model, so it always appears to be in front of the model. And then that's probably all I want to say about. Be careful, sometimes you might get the Z flipped, positive Z versus negative Z. I get them wrong all the time, and I just try the other one, and it works. I should mention a lot of these beautiful images here are from the book Real-Time Rendering. And again, I didn't ask you guys, I don't want you guys to go buy 100 books for this course, but a lot of this material for today and Wednesday and some in the future weeks comes from the book Real-Time Rendering. So if you have it, or if you're interested in getting it, if you're doing some serious graphics work, I totally recommend it. And check it out. Like their chapter 2 walks right through the pipeline, similar to this. Okay, so the projection matrices, we're going to be using perspective, right? Because the perspective matrix has the foreshortening effect, so that things farther away look smaller and that parallel lines converge. You can also use orthographic, which the CAD people like to do, so that parallel lines are preserved. And again, the projection matrix, you won't have to compute by hand, but you will have the parameters that you need to compute it, the field of view and the aspect ratio and so on. So we kind of already discussed this earlier, but here, once you go through the model view and projection matrix, we're in clip coordinates. And you can do the matrix multiply separately, or you can burn them together. Right? Or you can do any combination of these. So I want to talk about a pretty simple effect that's called vertex pulsing. This is from the CG tutorial, which CG is a shading language by NVIDIA called C for graphics. And it was, one of the first. In fact, I think it might have been out before GLSL. And they have a book. It's online for free, and there's hard copies, called the CG tutorial, which is like an intro to shading on GPUs. And they have a few examples that I think are good. One is this pulsing example. And here they're showing a model, and they make it pulse vertically over time. So this is like an alien, and the guy comes like in and out like that.
And it kind of goes up and down, sort of like a sine wave. So, you know, maybe this
yeah, you're playing a game and you just shocked the alien or something, you took damage. So how do you think that we could do this in the vertex shader? So we're gonna write a little code that modifies each vertex. And right now we're seeing the vertex shader that we're doing what we have to do, which is we're gonna transform it into clip coordinates. But now I'm saying, well, geez, it's generally useful for, say, animation, and this is one example of animation. So what ideas do you have for how we could make this object pulse? And this is a dynamic pulsing, like, over time, and it goes, like, up and down. What do you think we could do? No ideas. Move the vertex. That's part of the answer, for sure. Okay, so tell me more about how we would move it. Move it along the normal. Okay, that's. So I agree with you, and the CG tutorial also agrees with you, that we can move the position along the normal. So assuming that these vertices have positions and normals, and that's a reasonable assumption to make, these normals are always facing away from the surface. Everyone knows what a normal is. They're comfortable. A normal is usually a unit vector perpendicular to surface that kind of determines the orientation, surface orientation. Okay, so I totally agree that we want to displace positions over the normal, or even in the opposite direction of the normal if we wanted to shrink it. That's a good start, and if we just wanted to scale the guy up and down, we could do that. But we want to get this pulsing effect where it's kind of up and down over here, and it's animated and kind of swings and looks nice. So what else could we do? Or how do we build on this? Assign. Okay, and then so what do you think about my code here? So what I'm saying is the displacement, which is how far along the normal are we going to move the point? So it's going to be like, you know, point equals point plus displacement times normal, right? Because we're just trying to scale that point along the normal. Here, I have some value called time. We'll talk about that in a second. I'm going to take this sine function, which typically, as you said, goes from -1 to 1. And here, the scale and bias brings it from 0 to 1. So we're not shrinking the object at all. We're just making it go bigger. You don't have to do that, though. You could certainly shrink it if you want. And this time value varies. Every time we render it, we'll just increase the time. You know, you can do it at any frequency you want. But this is something that, over time, goes up. So here we kind of get this effect where the object's going to get bigger and smaller based on the sine, right? But when I ask what are shortcomings, does it give us this effect that we're looking for? So do you guys agree with me that every vertex here would be getting displaced by the same value? So all you're doing is kind of like taking the whole object out and back.
And we're not getting this kind of this curvature right here.
So what else do you think we could do?
Can the best sine function to the vertices that are on the pixels?
You can write, we will talk about later in this pipeline here. Oh, and just so I'm super clear, this is an example of something that we can do in the vertex shader. This is not like, you have to write this in your vertex shader for your CUDA rasterizer. This is just one example. But there is a stage for fragments, so where you could do something on individual pixels. For this particular effect, I don't think that it's useful. We might.
With the function that you have, the values are always going to be between 0 and 1.
So
they're going to be negative.
Right, and that's fine. And it's up to you. So in this example, we're only letting him, when he pulses, he's only getting bigger. Mm-hmm. But if you wanted to shrink him, you don't have to do the scale and bias. Yep? Yeah, so that's brilliant. things. Exactly right. So this is a vertex shader, and we have input, which includes the vertex, which we're assuming here has positions and normals. And if we just tweak this function a little bit so that the sine call is dependent on the model's position, we can kind of get this pulsing effect so that now we're not globally shrinking it, but we're kind of locally doing it based on the position. So let's take a look at some code. I fixed this. The other thing that I should mention is that you're right, this goes between 0 and 1, and we probably want to change that so that we might want to change it depending on the model, because depending on the coordinates, 0 to 1 might be really small, or it might be really big, right? So that's, sorry, what you see here with the scale factor. And then the frequency that I'm showing here, this is just like a user-defined parameter. Like users, artists, they just love parameters. They just want sliders, and they want to tweak things. So I didn't make the algorithm like any better here. I just added some things that we could tweak. Because that was the first shortcoming, but we went right to the important one. Okay, so in terms of the varying, one simple tweak, just the position of y, is enough to get the effect that we desire here. And this is, I'm assuming that this position is in local model coordinates. You could do it in other coordinate systems. Like if you did it in world coordinates, then it would, as the model moved in the world, you'd kind of see it, like him like walking through the function, which would be pretty interesting. But I just want to show that this is one line of code here, and it's all that's needed to get, you know, a pretty interesting effect like this. And it's, you know, it's going to you're going to execute it for each vertex, and as I'm sure you can expect by this point, since we're going to do it in CUDA and then later with GLSL, it's all data parallel, right? So it's going to be the same program, this program, this line of code, each running on a different set of data, where the data there is the vertex. Let me see, what's this next slide? Yeah, so how much of this really varies per vertex out of all this? Position.y varies. Right, so do you guys agree with me that this is constant right here, scale factor times 0.5, that's constant, right? Frequency times time is constant, right? So if we have a whole lot of vertices, these are things that we would want to pre-compute, and we wouldn't want to do this redundant multiplication for all the vertices, right? Because think of your kernel, it would be less kernel code, right? This is going to be in your kernel, and if we don't have to have these in there, then we're going to factor them out. And it's, you know, it's certainly very common optimization that's done in graphics for sure, is we pull everything that's constant along a large number of vertices, or you could think kernel launches for now, we're going to pull out and do once on the CPU. Okay, so the other thing that the vertex shader can do, not only does it get vertices coming in, and then you modify the vertex, and then you get these things called uniforms, which we've really said, we kind of like those matrices. But the other data that we can give to it is textures, is 2D, 1D, 2D, or 3D images. Just think like you're going to wrap an image around an object. And these are used for texture mapping and computer and fragment shading. They're used for bump mapping, normal mapping, used all over the place. One thing that they're useful for with vertices here is called displacement mapping. So if you recall from 460, we can take a surface and then we can have a map or a texture that defines the offsets from that surface. And then you can displace the surface at runtime. So like here is flat water, you know, here's the curve, here is the water with waves, and same deal here. So with the one thing you can do with vertex shaders is if you can read the texture map, you can use that to displace your vertex such that you get displacement mapping. In this case, when it first came out, you know, the killer app was water. And it came out a while ago. It came out in the GeForce 6. Which is before even CUDA and all. This came out in like 2004, and it was, or late 2003. And it was actually kind of a pain because you can have all these different formats for textures, and sometimes each component, for example, might be floating point. Each component, and when I say component, I think like red, green, blue, alpha, or GBA. You might have floating point components, you might have unsigned byte components, unsigned int, and so on. And only like two formats were ever fast with the Vertex shader when you read them from the Vertex shader. And I think it went into software otherwise. So like you'd always see all these questions about it. I'm reading a texture in a Vertex shader and I only get half a frame a second. What's going on? But now I assure you that it's super fast in the hardware. But from your rendering, from your CUDA rasterizer point of view, I want you to think that, you know, when you think about data coming into your Vertex shader, you can also have big 2D arrays if you want to do something for, like displacement mapping. Okay, so I want to do a slight detour here just for a second because I love to pitch technologies for your final projects. Although, as I've discussed with some of you, I do not have a good, I don't know definitely what to do with this for your final project, but I know that if you come up with something cool, I will say yes to you doing it. What we're looking at here are videos for something called CSS shaders, which takes a Vertex shader and brings it to the web. So if you do any web programming and say you have an HTML element, you can, with CSS shaders, you can break it down into a bunch of triangles, and then you can run a Vertex shader. You can write a program to modify each one to try to get some cool effects. Like here they're showing the flipbook. The other one that I'm kind of interested in, because I do a lot of mapping, is this map that's getting folded and unfolded. And this runs in the web browser. I had some students interested in using it for a final project last semester. Unfortunately, there were no implementations available for this yet. But now, there are, or I don't want to say there are, there is at least one implementation available. It's still pretty early in development, and it totally crashed my machine when I ran one of them. But nonetheless, I think that you should totally explore this if you guys are interested in web. And it can't be something super soft either. Like, you know, so you can also execute the CSS shaders per fragment to it per pixel, and like no getting away with, I'm going to write an image processing library using CSS shaders. That's too easy. That's like an assignment that I would give you 6 hours to do. But if you have other ideas for some more complicated stuff, I'm definitely interested in hearing about it. Let me see if there's anything else here. Yeah, here, I want to show you this picture. Where they're trying to show you, like, here's an HTML element, and then you can say the tessellation. How many triangles is it? And then you can write your shader, your Vertex shader, to manipulate individual vertices from that triangle. And then later you can run it through a fragment shader, which will allow you to manipulate individual pixels. So take a look if you're interested in web stuff. That would fall into a good category. Okay, so today we'll finish with the Vertex shader stuff before we go into primitive assembly. I just want to show you a few demos. I'm going to switch back to my laptop, which I apologize. I know it's not great. Okay, so RenderMonkey is a free tool from AMD. And it's a tool for authoring shaders. So you're going to have very simple Vertex and Fragment shaders in your CUDA rasterizer, but we'll see that these are really part of the OpenGL pipeline that people use. And this tool helps you author these shaders. And there's several examples for Vertex shaders and Fragment shaders in here. And if you adapt anything from this for your rasterizers, you have to be very clear as to like what you did. You know what I mean? Like, I probably would allow you to port some of this stuff, but like the meat of your project, and for the rasterizer it really isn't, but like the meat of your project can't be like, I just took this code and ported it, like that doesn't matter. But if you already get your rasterizer working, and then you want to add a couple interesting use cases, you could look in here for ideas. But here, this bounce and then the interaction, or the fake interaction, I'll say, with this plane. This is all done in the Vertex shader, and it's just varied over time with some ease in and ease out for the speed of the ball. And I'll show you one or two more. Another thing that's really easy to do in here is Vertex shader morphing. So here it's just morphing and then kind of overshooting between spheres and the box. And that's only if you, the shader is really small. And I'll show you something that I've done with Vertex Shader Morph that was a. So I showed you guys these demos last week that I went to Boston to show a bunch of people. That went really well, by the way, when I went to Boston, and I talked a little bit about this course, and I showed some of the path tracers from last semester. So I make you guys famous even after you're gone. So they were very well, and they asked me so many questions about your path tracers. It was unbelievable. Okay, so am I online? Let's cut the lights on. So here's one of these apps that I showed you last week, and it's got some satellites flying around in a 3D globe. And then our API, we make an API to do this stuff, also does 2D. So here I flew down in the 2D, and we can go back to 3D. And this morphing here is all done in a vertex shader, where we know where it is in 3D, where it is in 2D, and then we just interpolate between them. Linear is lame, so nonlinear is better. And then we also have what's called Columbus view, which is like a 2.5D view where we unfold the satellite orbits. So again, these transform, these morphs, which is, by the way, is how I got a lot of attention for this project when I was trying to get management buy-in before I went to demo to them. You know, I told my manager, I'm like, I'm working on this demo. I just can't get it to work. It doesn't work. I was totally lying. And I'm like, I'm just going to go in there and I'll present it anyway. And then I came in with these morphs, and they just loved it. Oh, this is great. And since then, it's been pretty good with the project. So that's just another example for the Vertex Shader. So tell me, before we finish here, are you guys pretty comfortable so far with, we're looking at this pipeline, and we're going to send triangles through this pipeline. And so far, we pretty much just said, okay, we got to get a vertex, and then we're going to throw it through this stage that transforms it to clip coordinates. It doesn't model your projection matrices. The Patrick assures me that I don't have to compute myself, that I will get from an API, and then and potentially can do other cool things like animation or anything involved per vertex. And it could read extra data, like textures. Sound pretty good so far? Good. Hopefully, maybe at least half review or something before 60. All right, cool. So in terms of, I keep saying rasterizer. When is it coming out? I am not sure. The soonest it will come out is Wednesday, but it may be next week. I'll talk to Carl and we'll figure it out. In the meantime, you know, you guys have worked hard on your ray tracer and path tracer. Enjoy your downtime. Do some reading. Reading is good. And we'll see you on Wednesday.